Welcome to the ASHP Advantage Podcast, engaging the experts on ASHP Official, featuring conversations with top-level practitioners about the latest issues in pharmacy and healthcare.
Thanks for joining us in this episode of Pharmacy Hot Topics, where we sit down with content matter experts and discuss what is currently top of mind in the world of pharmacy. My name is Mike Gagno. I'm Senior Director of Pharmacy Practice and Quality with ASHP, and I'm joined by Patty Keenly, Director of Accreditation and Medication Safety at Cardinal Health, and Orchid Motihari, who's a sterile compounding designated person and clinical oncology pharmacist at Martha's Vineyard Hospital in Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts. Today's episode is part of the ASHP Advantage podcast series, Engaging the Experts, featuring conversations with top-level practitioners. This episode is supported by Pfizer Incorporated, USA, and is for informational purposes and not approved for continuing education credit. Thanks for joining us today. Let's get started talking about today's topic, compliance with USP Chapter 797 in small and rural hospitals. Orchid, Patty, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what areas pose a challenge to small and rural hospitals on their way to fully adopt the new 797 standards?
Thank you, Mike. There's no doubt that rural hospitals are the lifeline for thousands of small communities in America, but unfortunately, increasing financial difficulties of these institutions are a known fact and a significant barrier to building and having a fully compliant sterile compounding facility. Limited space and aging infrastructure is another challenge. Building or expanding a sterile compounding facility often requires making extreme makeovers to existing outdated structures and engineering. Also, small hospital pharmacies that operate with only one person are not uncommon. If not, they have a small group of staff that are cross-trained in multiple areas and expected to switch gears quickly when needed. Finding coverage for staff member who cannot compound due to sickness or failing competency evaluation means pulling another from hospital-wide medication distribution or order verification activities with a domino effect sometimes ending with pharmacy director stepping in. These types of hospitals often do not have in-house experts who are trained and specialized in supporting sterile compounding operations, especially in terms of infection control, technology, and engineering. As a result, these services are sometimes outsourced, but the high cost and concerns over quality control and regulatory compliance of these services are an add-on financial and regulatory pressure. Lastly, these hospitals are primarily located in remote and sometimes hard to access areas. In the case of Martha's Vineyard, an island only accessible by air or ferry, weather issues can cause access delays that significantly impact time-sensitive tasks performed by outside vendors. For rural hospitals in remote areas, sterile compounding operations shut down due to excursions or mechanical failure often means the only sterile compounding facility within a 35 miles radius or greater is out of commission.
Yeah, some interesting points there that I think many of our listeners probably don't consider unless they're in a similar situation. You know, one thing I have found interesting, if you're familiar with the ASHP National Survey of Hospital Pharmacy Practice, we do a sampling of hospitals across the country for our survey, and one of the remarkable statistics is that about half of the hospitals in the U.S., non-federal hospitals, are 50 bed or smaller. And so I think it's probably underappreciated just how small and rural most of our healthcare delivery is in a lot of these areas. Patty, any thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, some of the other things that I've found with small hospitals is especially on the ambulatory side. There are plenty of small and rural hospitals that have as large infusion centers as a medium-sized hospital in, you know, a good-sized city. So we don't realize the fact that everybody needs to be practicing from the same standards, right? So we can't expect that people aren't doing things in these smaller hospitals, because they are. I mean, it's a pretty significant thing. So balancing that with the need for more immediate use preparations, for example, because a lot of places aren't staffed 24/7. They may be staffed 7 days a week, but very rarely will a small hospital have somebody physically on staff there at night. So we need to include all of those other practitioners in the 797 standards as well. And it's not just nursing. It's people like imaging and anesthesia, for example, and any of those other disciplines that may be mixing sterile preparations have to be included in this.
Yeah, very good points, Patty. So, Orchid, given all of those challenges that you described, how did your hospital prepare for the chapter revisions?
The short answer is that we built a clean room. MVH had a segregated compounding area for years before breaking ground for a new clean room in 2019. From initial design to moving into our new space, the clean room construction project lasted about 3 years, including a pause in 2020. During the 3 years before transitioning to our new clean room, we developed the required USP 797 policies and procedures and assigned them to staff to study as part of their clean room training and didactics. We performed a comprehensive review of CSPs prepared in MVH and developed the recipe book that was eventually incorporated into our clean room remote pharmacist verification system. BUDs for each recipe were updated to reflect USP revisions and change from SCA to ISO classified clean rooms. During the final phases of construction, staff toured the new facility, practiced the workflow, stimulated different sterile compounding scenarios, such as material and people movement, garbing, cleaning. And after the initial cleaning and certification, we also performed a round of staff competency evaluation in the new clean room. We are currently in the process of rolling out our annual nursing competencies by working closely with nursing management and nursing educators. Unfortunately, there were also challenges in preparing for the revisions. In retrospect, more time should have been dedicated to the installation and rollout of information and communication technology in our clean room. Another issue was shortcomings in communication between pharmacy and HVAC teams, which is crucial in creating and maintaining the delicate balance of environmental factors in a clean room.
Yeah, some interesting, I would call them innovative solutions there. Like the simulation of movement and materials as you're finishing the clean room is actually a really good idea and probably helpful for others who are opening up a new space. Patty, any thoughts?
Yeah, just some of the same kind of situations. Orchid, you mentioned in the beginning about some of the aging facilities. And that's something I see pretty frequently, is that people don't realize the sophistication that we need for some of these things, air handling, for example. So often those things that you mentioned, Orchid, that you look back on, I think that's really important for people to know what those barriers were and what those stumbling blocks were so that they can plan ahead for that. And you fortunately were very, forward-looking in planning this. And a lot of people now are just kind of catching up to that. So the things that went wrong is very useful to other people.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And, Orchid, you mentioned in the beginning some of the limited resources you're working with, but you've managed to accomplish a lot. You care to talk about, how you did that?
Thank you, Mike. I think for small rural hospitals, the most important milestone and that can be achieved with limited resources is ensuring staff competency when it comes to sterile compounding practices. Hand hygiene, PPE, environmental cleaning are core values of sterile compounding and infection control. It does not matter how sophisticated our sterile compounding facility engineering and design is, if there are gaps in sterile compounding personnel's knowledge and practice of standard precautions, the quality of CSPs, and the state of control in our clean room or SCA will be compromised. So before going any further, focus should be placed on personnel hand hygiene, garbing, gloving, aseptic technique, cleaning routines. Next is designing a didactics and competency evaluation program for both pharmacy and nursing. In the case of nursing competencies, working with nursing management and nurse educators in designing a program that meets your institution's needs and preferences can expedite the process, and it's extremely helpful. Also, developing policies, easy to follow standard operating procedures that are readily available to your staff is a huge milestone for your small institutions. This helps you ensure that facility, operation, and staff consistently meet minimum USB practices standards. Next is BUD assignments based on stability, sterility, sterile compounding categories, and make sure a copy of USB regulations and reputable and frequently updated literature and databases are available to pharmacists to help them assign proper BUDs and storage conditions. I also recommend developing a recipe book that details the compounding process, storage conditions, and BUDs. Finally, I would say avoid becoming overwhelmed. Evaluate the state of sterile compounding in your institution. See what you can do with resources on hand. And at the same time, advocate for resources you don't have.
Avoid becoming overwhelmed. I think a lot of folks are probably challenged with that, regardless of the size or location of their hospital. Patty, you're in a lot of different hospitals and some have limited resources. Anything to add?
Well, one of the things, about that, don't become overwhelmed piece, I have run into a few places where they're saying, I just can't handle this. I'm going to turf it all back to nursing. And that is not an appropriate approach for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's our responsibility to do that. And I realize that's a whole lot easier for me to say than people who have the boots on the ground to be able to do that. But from an accreditation perspective too, Joint Commission, for example, and I realize not everyone is accredited by Joint Commission, but Joint Commission has said and references the CMS conditions of participation that said pharmacy has a responsibility to do this. So it's really a balance. Like Orchid, you're at a place where that has an oncology service too. So, that's one end of the spectrum. I think some of the small and rural places, there are some that do very few IVs. So you have to kind of balance that whole situation. But I really think that it's our responsibility to make sure that we're not giving away the pharmacy practice, the basic pharmacy practice things that we need to do. So your approach to this has been very comprehensive and really, an admirable way of handling this from a small and rural perspective.
And Orchid, you talked a little bit about that that simulation that you went through as you opened up the clean room or you were preparing to open. What else did you do to assess readiness before going live?
Thank you, Mike. We performed frequent gap analyses along the way to identify the problem areas. ASHP has a comparison chart titled USB 797 Key Changes, which itemizes the revisions made to the regulations and provides a summary of the old and new language side by side. This document was extremely helpful in assessing our readiness. I still find myself going back to it for guidance or just to refresh my memory. Other tools we benefited from were the USB 797 Frequently Asked Questions document, in addition to ASHP and BPS continuing education courses. Please keep in mind that readiness might look good on paper, but in practice, you might find out that more work is needed to be done. And that is why it is crucial to assess readiness through staff observation, touring the facility based on scientific data, and with the help from experts in the field. For example, we assessed the staff readiness through competency testing, numerous hours of daily observation of their practices, and simply by just holding one-on-one conversations with the staff. The facility's readiness was evaluated by studying the certification reports and monitoring temperature, humidity, pressure around the clock, also by performing environmental testing, which exceeded the minimum requirements in both frequency of testing and number of sample locations. Lastly, we reviewed the entire series of sterile compounding policies and procedures and made sure they reflected the latest USB regulations.
Great. And Patty, you helped us review that 797 Key Changes document, and we appreciate that. That was Kevin Hansen and one of his students at the time who developed that. Good to hear that that's been a useful resource.
Yeah, I mean, that's great information that's on the Compounding Resource Center and on the ASHP site. So don't lose you know, track of that. All of that information is good. There's a lot of really good documents there. Or could you mention the FAQs from USP? That information changes from time to time too, and it really brings up more contemporary issues that are there. I think doing a gap analysis is critical for this. And one thing to keep in mind is this should not be stealth information in your organization. Don't just keep it in pharmacy. Make sure that, you know, the quality department knows if there's gaps in there that you have to do, that your direct report knows. And that comes up from a quality perspective in accreditation standards, as well as inspections from your state board of pharmacy. So make sure you know what those gaps are, and that others in your organization who can support you in that, risk management, for example, are also aware of any things that need to get done.
And speaking of different resources and educational programs, is there anything different, ORCID, for small hospitals, rural hospitals, as far as educational programs for your team?
Thank you, Mike. In the case of small rural hospitals with limited resources and a shortage of experts with boots on the ground, I think targeted educational programs that provide an opportunity for small rural hospitals to come forward and ask for guidance, even anonymously, are crucial and sometimes really the only sounding board available to these small institutions due to differences in type, size, available resources, services provided, and other characteristics unique to each facility. There is great degree of variation in the rate and extent of USP 797 compliance from one sterile compounding facility to the other. In addition, the revised USP 797 leaves certain decisions up to individual institutions to make based on their preferences, which could cause an even greater degree of variability across the board. As a result, educational programs and discussion panels tailored to the specific situation and needs of different categories of sterile compounding institutions can help increase the rate and extent of their regulatory compliance.
And Patty, again, you're in a lot of hospitals. What do you see as far as educational needs for various sizes or resources available?
I think people are depending on ASHP, for example. Perhaps their buying group has some offerings that are there. There's a lot of CE and even, you know, non-CE related good content that's available. Again, ASHP has a lot of resources on the site. ASHP Connect, where people can ask questions and really get responses from those in similar organizations or dissimilar organizations that maybe be able to provide some really valuable information. So there's a lot of resources out there from a virtual perspective that people can depend on.
And I agree with the, I'm not going to plug ASHP resources, but the USP FAQ documents are more than likely someone has thought of the question before you and, you know, it's been answered somewhere. And if not, you know, I agree there's an opportunity to reach out. And I will say, you know, as far as that Connect community, that the compounding one specifically, we stood that up about a year ago, and it has been probably one of the most active ASHP Connect communities that we've ever had. So some of the other requirements that I think small rural hospitals might struggle with are, the increased surveillance for environmental monitoring, surface sampling, et cetera. Some hospitals may not even have their own lab. Does that mean you're automatically sending out microbiologic samples, or how is this kind of surveillance happening in smaller hospitals?
Well, it's kind of interesting where there is no lab, or there's perhaps, you know, one or two med techs who may be doing some processing, but often from a microbiological standpoint is sending that out to another lab. You have to kind of think of yourself as the lab. So there's requirements that you need to be aware of. Incubation, for example. This isn't something many people have just stored things at room temp, like on a shelf, and that's not adequate anymore. It has to be in an incubator. So there's a need for those. So you've got a physical incubator that you may need. Some people will say, well, gee, what do I do? I need a microbiologist to consult if I have some issues and I don't have one here at the hospital. But think in terms of What does your certifier do? If your certifier is sending out environmental samples for you, they're sending it to a lab. So there's a microbiologist who has at least taken a look at that. So that may be an opportunity for you. You probably, well, if you're in a critical access hospital anyway, you have a referral hospital that's there. So maybe the microbiologist in that referral hospital can be there. And don't lose track of the point that you have an infection control practitioner at your hospital as well. So they can be a really good ally and provide some of those resources, or at least some places where you may be able to send things to, and you may be able to work that out either at your hospital site or with some resources that you already have and may not be aware of.
Yeah, those are some important things to keep in mind. And ORCID, do you have any words of wisdom to add to that as far as your surveillance?
No, Mike, I just, as I said, I think it's the main point is just, as you also talked about, it is just not being overwhelmed and take it one at a time and make sure to have oversight, regardless of your resources, regardless of being able to accomplish something now or in the future, just make sure you need to have oversight.
Yeah, I think that's critical. A very good point. And I like how you broke down the chapter and had each part, assigned or taken care of. And that really, I think that would really prevent people from feeling overwhelmed. Like you said, take it one part at a time. Well, I really want to thank you both, ORCID, Patty, for joining me today. That is all the time we have. This was a really good discussion. We have an upcoming Frontline Conversations with both Patty and ORCID, where you can bring your questions live for our faculty experts to address. So you'll have another opportunity to hear from our experts. And we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. Be sure to subscribe to ASHP Podcast through your favorite podcast provider. Patty, ORCID, thank you again.
Thanks, Mike.
Thanks for joining us for the ASHP Advantage Podcast, Engaging the Experts. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time for more expert perspectives on ASHP Official.